The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Matt Broughton, Senior Editor at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to be joined by our special guest today, who is Katie Atkinson, founder of The Runway Media. Hello to you, Katie.
Hi, everyone.
And joining us this week is our, you know, intrepid CEO, Irish counterpart on the other side of the office, Kieran O'Kane, CEO of ExchangeWire.
Hello, Matt. Hello, Katie. It's great to be back again after a couple of months hiatus. And I want to apologize for the last time I was on. So I seem to get kicked off every so often for bad manners.
Put on the naughty step.
Yeah, I'll be good today. I'll hold back my anti-Google and Meta rants to a minimum of 2 minutes.
Well, the first story will be quite interesting for that in that case. Diving straight into that one, Apple is secretly buying Google Ads for high-value apps to siphon millions of dollars in subscription revenue, according to a report published in Forbes. Under the scheme, Apple has been placing ads for subscription services which route directly to their app store rather than the developer's own website or platform, with affected brands including Tinder, Bumble, HBO, Masterclass, and Babbel. While this free advertising may be seen by some as a benefit for developers, the move can severely customize customer lifetime value. If a customer was to subscribe to a service directly, the developer would receive all the funds, whereas if they were to sign up by the App Store, the developer would be obliged to pay 30% commission to Apple on all future payments. This behavior comes amid ongoing scrutiny into that commission tariff in the wake of its highly publicized legal case with Epic Games. Last week, Apple's request for a stay against the ruling that it should allow app developers to offer their own in-app payment systems was denied. According to one developer affected by Apple's actions, anyone that understands the basics of arbitrage could invent this. We all know what Apple's doing for its privacy stuff is for its own pockets. It doesn't sit right that in the background they've been doing this to developers. It's not ethical. Now, Apple has since released a statement saying that the Forbes report amounts to an overt mischaracterization of their platform and that developers are fully aware of the ads it runs against their apps. Keen to get your guys' first impressions on this and to, you know, understand what steps can developers take, if any, to mitigate against Apple's actions. Katie, let's start with you.
Okay, so I feel quite strongly about this, actually, being in the weeds with a lot of D2C clients and dealing with the situation post-ATT. And it appears that once again, Apple are crushing small businesses in the name of profit. If you search download Netflix, you can see that sign up within iOS apps is not supported. So users need to go directly to Netflix, sign up for Netflix, and then download the iOS app to view. Thus, Netflix avoid the 30% fee. However, Netflix can do this as they've got deep pockets and huge brand awareness. People search for Netflix directly and they're happy to jump through a few hoops to sign up for all that amazing content. However, if you're a brand with very little brand awareness, you can't really bid on brand terms. You're kind of bidding on category terms. So, for example, fitness apps. So that means you're really, really reliant on Apple and you've just got nowhere else to go. Especially now post-ATT, where Apple have absolutely decimated the other walled gardens. And I was actually told recently, a lot of tech businesses aren't even taking app download campaigns anymore. So Apple have absolutely got the monopoly and they're kind of forcing these small developers into a corner. What do you think, Kieran?
What do I expect? I couldn't expect any less of Apple. So just to get this straight, Apple are buying ads on Google, right? And redirect them to the apps of Bumble or whoever. Over, so they're outbidding Bumble for their own placements on Google, Google search, so that they go through the Apple ecosystem to basically keep the subscriptions. I mean, this is what monopolies do. They're like rabid dogs. You need to muzzle them. Like, you know, I've a strangely contrarian view over ATT. I think it's the best thing to ever happen to ad tech, actually, in a way, because it gets us off like IDs and cookies and makes us think about other metrics that which will benefit the open ecosystem. It forces it to innovate, but this is rampant monopolistic behavior. It's disgraceful, actually, and it just shows up the arrogance of Apple. to an unbelievable point that they're basically waving their bits and pieces at the legislators and, you know, competition authorities. Look, we'll do this anyway. We're going to screw you over. I mean, it's incredible. And all they're doing is they're increasing bid inflation for those keywords for the brands, is costing the brands more money. To Katie's point, they could literally just throw money at this, because their view is it's going to cost us X to keep these people buying subscriptions, and subscriptions are basically recurring revenue, whereas the media campaigns are sort of like we can offset the cost by keeping people on the subscription gravy train for us. I don't know what to say about this. Like Apple doesn't seem to know when to stop. Google doesn't know when to stop. And you know, Google has, there's reports in the Wall Street Journal that, as per the case being brought by Texas and other states in the US, that they were colluding with the likes of Facebook around header bidding and trying basically to squash independent attempts to kind of like go around the Google ad stack. Oh, I don't know, but monopolies are out of control. I'm a capitalist. I believe in a capitalist system, but you get to a point where two companies, particularly Google and Apple, who control the two biggest mobile ecosystems in the world, iOS and Android, that they are so big and so strong that they can do anything. I just can't believe how damaging. I don't know who's in the PR team at Apple, but this is ridiculous. Like, this is such bad optics for the company that they would even try and do this. And it does indicate that this money is significant for Apple if they're doing this in the first place.
Well, I mean, if you look at it, you might pay $5 for a click, but then you're making $50 off the subscription revenue every year.
Isn't it interesting that Apple's playing the same CPA game against the people they're trying to kill on the ATT side? Like, you know, Apple have a massive ads business. It is not disclosed in their numbers, right? But I have it on good authority that Apple are making multi-billions and billions of dollars over those two ad placements in the actual app store, the one at the top of the page, and then their prospecting ad, and without even doing, you know, without joining the rest of their ecosystem together, which they will, they're going to have a massive ad network. But that's the problem when you have these monopolies. They're able to affect the independent ecosystem to their own advantage.
On the ruling that Apple had to open its payment systems up to allow third parties in that regard, will it, you know, force a change of approach from them, or will they continue going down this avenue of locking off their ecosystem?
Well, I mean, they're going to have to open up their walled garden, aren't they? Because they have been, you know, legally they have to now. They have to allow developers to include outside links in their apps. It won't delay Google in terms of any moves to kind of lose the mobile advertising ID. They're already deep in the privacy sandbox looking at cohorts. They don't care. Individual IDs are dead to Google now. So it is interesting that Apple are kind of backtracking.
I tend to take a positive view of this. Apple and Google and Amazon are flying so close to the wire right now that they have little room to maneuver. And only actions like this would just infuriate the competition authorities in the US and Europe and UK and elsewhere in the world to actually make a change here. I don't know what, like, Apple's a tricky one because it's such an integrated system, whereas Google have many moving parts, right? If you took a knife to Google, you could easily throw off YouTube and its ad tech stack and Chrome and Android and be left with a fairly decent business amount. But Apple just seem to have integrated their entire stack, and I don't know what you do about that. I'm not so much worried about Apple's ad business. I mean, I've come to believe that as an industry, we should not be relying on IDs and cookies as a proxy for the way that we measure and we target ads, right? And I actually think if we go all in on privacy, I suppose it's a bit like being a vegetarian or vegan. I'm not au fait with either of those things, but like, you go all in it, you're going to live a healthier life, right? You know, so to speak. It won't be as fun, but it'll be a healthier life. But that's my point. We need to forget about hacking privacy, and we should forget about IDs and cookies. We should think about right, what can we do that's privacy first? And as an industry, that's where we'll get to. I think that, Katie, you're going to have to buy more Apple search ads going forward, because it'll probably be the only way for you to properly optimize in that ecosystem.
You know what, actually, Kieran, we've actually abandoned them altogether.
Oh, really?
Volume, yeah, we buy tube car panels if we're trying to drive that downloads.
Hold on, what?
You buy tube car panels because you're sitting there, high dwell time, free Wi-Fi, no one's got anything to do. They absolutely fly.
Interesting. That's random.
Yeah, no, honestly, it's not. For anyone that knows outdoor, they sell out.
Okay, yeah. That's great.
So it is great. And that's, I think, what will happen with Apple. They'll be pushing people outside of digital media, because anyone who's actually doing things at scale and working with an agency will be looking at the overall consumer landscape and what the habits are.
So as a buyer, you're becoming more omni-channel focused, and you're looking at how the home actually works with these campaigns because it delivers.
Absolutely.
So the ad inflation piece that Apple are trying, and this is the other thing, Matt, that's important to know here, is that once these monopolies get a hold, they'll just keep putting prices up. So the very thing that the competition authority was trying to stop, which is basically higher prices, is going to happen inevitably anyway. Both Google and Facebook continue to do it. Like, Facebook is garbage. I mean, if there was proper verification done on that platform, everybody would realize that there's double accounts, that the content is absolute dog shit, right? There is no brand safety in Facebook. It is the worst environment for a brand. And that all you're doing is spending money against all these smaller brands, and you're not actually building a brand at all. Ultimately, you're just feeding the machine to keep the prices going, and you're caught in this like vicious loop. Anyway, we've gone completely left field here after like, anyway, Apple's bad.
That's a strong way of finishing off that first story. Diving into the second one, Instagram is offering influencers hefty bonuses for posting short-form video content via its Reels platform, with creators being offered up to $10,000. Rival platforms YouTube Shorts and Snapchat Spotlight have both already offered cash incentives to creators to lure them away from TikTok, which recently surpassed 1 billion monthly active users. While Instagram is discouraging users from posting content from elsewhere by deflating any videos posted with watermarks from other platforms, YouTube is taking an alternative approach by actively targeting TikTok creators, offering up to $50,000 to popular TikTokers to post 100 YouTube shorts over a period of 6 months. The Reels incentive program has experienced teething issues, with some creators affected by the recent outage to Meta-owned platforms. More concerning to influencers, however, is the lack of transparency around payments, with one creator with 24,000 followers offered up to $8,500, which was the same amount offered to a creator with only 800 followers. Some users have also reported a significant drop in the performance of their Reels after signing up to the bonus program. My first question to you guys is, how can this lack of transparency in influencer marketing be improved? And what do you guys think of the Reels platform and cash incentives being offered to creators? Kieran?
I mean, look, it's a great time to quit your job and become a creator, isn't it? That's my view in this. It's about time that these platforms are paying creators for the content creation. I don't know if you've seen that piece on the information that was covered Exchange Wire, that ByteDance is going to make $60 billion in revenue and is not paying any of its creators. So I think it's a good time to be in that space. I'm not surprised by this. Facebook always have to kind of own this shit. Like, they have to put their dirty claws in it. That watermark is hilarious. But I know that YouTube is definitely paying big dollar now to creators, because they see that, TikTok is like the unstoppable rise of TikTok. Those videos are, it's interesting, from what I've seen from TikTok, it's more of a consumption channel than a creator channel. People are almost using it as if it's like TV or next gen YouTube. Like, they just consume stuff on it. So I suppose that's the reason why the creators are a premium, because they need the content. Ultimately, these platforms are user generated content. It's subpar content in many ways. It's not like quality production you'd see on TV channels or CTV. So it is interesting. It's great. I mean, look, I'm not surprised once you get in there, it's a bit like when you started running AdSense on your site years ago. I don't know if you, if users are, our viewers, or sorry, listeners are old enough to remember this, but you know, you'd have a content site and you put on some Google AdSense and you might be making $2,000 or $3,000 a month. And you're saying, geez, I can retire now. And then like over a period of 12 months, you can start seeing it ratcheting down until it's like, you know, $300-$400. And I imagine it'll be same as the economies of scale here. The more creators you bring on, the more commoditized it becomes and the less money you get. And there'll probably be a couple of big dogs at the top making the most money. And then there'll be like a very long tail. So, but it's still good that people are getting paid for this stuff. And, you know, I wasn't joking. Like isn't there a stat somewhere that a lot of people have quit their jobs to become creators, like, you know, hold up in Huddersfield or some other armpit town like that. Like, apologies any from Huddersfield, but you know, like they're just creating stuff and getting paid by the big platforms.
Casey, what are your thoughts on this one?
Well, first of all, I agree with TikTok being a consumption channel. It's an absolute black hole. I had to delete it from my phone. I was losing an hour a day. it was unbelievable. But anyway, I don't have that problem anymore because I deleted it. So talking in terms of the question, in terms of transparency for payment. So it's not unusual for broadcast platforms, which is what these guys are, to court exclusivity of like high profile entertainers. Like look at ITV, look at Anton Deck, look at Gary Lineker in the BBC. That's normal. And these are grown up platforms now. So we shouldn't be surprised that they're offering creators incentives. And also it's not unusual for them to be different amounts. Like just because someone has got more followers doesn't necessarily mean they're the best kind of followers. They might, for example, the FT, it doesn't have the same reach of the Daily Mail, but it does very well in advertising because it attracts a lot of commercially like high-end customers. Also, for example, someone with less followers, they could be on a bigger growth trajectory. They could be producing more kind of trendy content. You know, there's a million different reasons why people are paid different amounts. However, where it gets ethical is looking at how the payments are split, obviously, by gender and by race. And if we want true transparency, then it should be published just like the gender pay gap, where these companies are forced to declare what they're paying people. And it's cut by age, by race, by gender, so that we can actually look and see if it is actually fair. What do you guys think about that?
I think that that would be a very logical move in the real world, but those platforms will never do that because they wouldn't want to expose what they're paying to their stars or give competitive analysis or competitive edge to anybody else. It is interesting. This is an interesting sort of development because a lot of these platforms went for years without paying their creators, and a lot of the creators depended on, you know, their own brand or the ads on the page to make money. So it is interesting now that the money is coming into this, and it's good. I suppose it creates competition. It means that more money has been distributed around. And I agree with you. I think, you know, there will be differences in what people are paid. And I guarantee you along those very lines, Katie, you're right that there will be discrepancies in, around race, gender, etc. But hopefully that talented people, based on the performance of their media or based on the performance in the actual vertical they are, like if you're giving financial advice, then you know you imagine that person is going to make bigger money because an insurance company or a free trade app or whatever will want to advertise against, versus someone who's like giving out, you know, make some soda bread or some other random thing that's very B2C and generic. So, but it's good to see that people are actually getting paid. It'll be interesting to see how the payment starts sort of like, you know, evening out, leveling out, and how the long tail does along this, because that's ultimately what happens in these situations. It's a spike, lots of press to get people on board, and then they're locked into this. But I think as long as if you're a creator, the smart thing to do is be on multiple platforms so you're getting paychecks from all over the place.
Makes sense. Switching perspective to kind of the brand side, how has brand interaction with the short form video content and influencer marketing in general set to evolve and change in the wake of privacy enforced changes across display and mobile?
Well, I think that now the tech isn't as robust, and I know, Kieran, you're going to disagree and say the tech is very robust, but within the walled gardens, where a lot of the sales happen, the tech is terrible now. Post ATT, there's no data, the algorithms aren't working, we can't retarget anyone, and it's difficult. So advertisers are having to lean on context and content in order to drive sales. Mm. So influencer content is more important than ever, but it's just making sure that you're working with the right influencers who are managed in the right way, who are delivering what they say they're going to deliver, and who are being measured. Because it is really, I know we're now, 5 years into working with big influencers, but it's still like the Wild West.
How do you work with them then? Is there an index saying this person has X amount of followers, or do brands rate them going, this guy or girl delivered X amount of sales for me? Like how do you, that must be a bloody nightmare trying to go out and sort of aggregate those influencers.
Well, I think if you've got the funds, the best thing to do is to work with an influencer marketing agency, for example, Takumi, who've got systems that can look at results and look at predicted reach and all the rest of it. If you are an independent brand, like a smaller brand, it's very, very difficult. You just have to make sure you're contracting with influencers and you're actually looking at their followership and actually making sure you're getting what you're paying for. Mm. I mean, I've heard absolute nightmares of smaller brands, for example, wallpapering influencers' houses and they're never getting a post. It's brutal. And a lot of influencers, I support small business and they don't support small business. Just making sure that everything's legally contracted. I suppose a way in which actually a lot of the platforms could help is by publishing terms of service that can be used by smaller brands, such as how many posts are expected, how many stories, what's the time length, what does an ideal influencer campaign look like, and basically giving a contract template. It would be really, really useful for smaller businesses.
Again, is that something that they would pursue, given that they want to kind of keep their terms of service under wraps, or is it something that we do expect going forward?
I mean, just a basic SLA, because you've got someone, they've got a wallpaper company. What do they know about working with influencers? But they'd expect that if they wallpaper someone's house, they'd get a bit from it. They'd get a bit of exposure off the back of it. But then for them to draft a legal framework might cost them £2,000. I do think these documents should be widely available, and it is kind of the responsibility of the platforms to produce them.
Yeah, definitely makes logical sense. But
hopefully gone down a sideline here.
I like it.
Yeah.
Giving Kieran ideas for his dance and wallpaper TikTok program coming soon to apps near you.
Yeah, I'm going to construct a new dance for what to call it, the wallpaper dance. It'll be like me wallpapering for some stupid... Like, oh, they always use the same generic tunes as well. I think they have these weird voices, and then they've got the same tunes as well. And it's fun. I don't know. Like, it just seemed to. It's a very weird world at TikTok. But good luck to them. $65 million. They must be doing well.
Moving on to the third news story of the week. Countries within the European Union have reached an agreement that the EU Commission is to be the sole enforcer of the proposed Digital Markets Act, which is set to restrict the behaviour of digital gatekeepers, which include Google, Meta, Amazon, Apple and Microsoft. The move is significant as earlier in June, national antitrust organisations argued that they should share enforcement powers under the EU Commission and have the legal authority to start investigations in their respective jurisdictions. Under the newly agreed rules, individual authorities can only carry out investigations at the request of the EU Commission. The ruling is seen as a blow to the French and German authorities, which have been ramping up their actions against big tech firms in recent years. This year alone, France's competition watchdog has dished out notable penalties, including a $592 million fine for Google and a $1.3 billion hit for Apple, while its German counterpart has opened investigations into Apple, Google and Amazon over the past 2 months alone. This centralized system for DMA action marks a sharp contrast to the system underpinning enforcement of GDPR, in which national data protection authorities take the lead on investigations. This particular approach has seen its fair share of critics, with the Irish Data Protection Commission facing particularly strong flak over its perceived inaction against big tech firms. Again, keen to get your first impressions of this and on that last point, to ascertain whether this centralized investigatory system will be more or less likely to work in curbing the actions of big tech firms. Katie, let's start with you.
So I suppose theoretically, this move does protect the interest of consumers and also the overall tech marketplace above the individual economies of the countries like Ireland, who are kind of could be perhaps perceived as being a little bit soft on these big tech firms. But without mentioning the B word, it does beg the question of why an organisation like the EU that has actually been set up for trading has now power over individual government legislation which affects their citizens. And that doesn't appeal that democratic to me. What do you think, Kieran?
Do you mean Brexit?
I'm so bored of talking about it.
Jesus Christ.
But you anyway.
You can't have a feckin' union of 400 million people, right? And you have every Mickey Mouse government riding roughshod over a charge against a anti-competitive thing. I think the centralized thing makes a lot of sense. I want the EU to be more aggressive about monopolies. I believe that that the European Union should work almost as a centralized piece in legislation and all the rest of it in terms of like how to police these companies. Because otherwise, how are you going to scale companies that can compete with the likes of Google and Facebook and Amazon and Apple in the US, right? You need to have sector champions in this part of the world as well, right? So you can't have countries like, you know, on a whim deciding, I don't like the look of that company. They're doing this, and this. I think the centralization thing is the right thing to do. I think that the EU needs to be more aggressive on these monopolies, but I don't think they should be anti big company in the sense that if a company scales, fine. What we have now is the digital ecosystem is controlled effectively by four companies, and that is not healthy for a free capitalist system, no matter where you are in the world, whether it's UK or the EU or, you know, Asia or whatever. Look, the reality is it? I think it's probably the EU is probably taking the decision going, we can't have multiple cases against these companies because it's a mismatch of different cases going on all the time. And really, you don't get anywhere like. I mean, I'm all for fining the likes of this, but fines are just a parking ticket for these companies. We need literally someone to sit down and take a hacksaw to likes of Google. Like the first thing I would do with Google is I would rip YouTube out of it, and I would rip all of its ad tech out of it. I'd take the double click piece, all of it, and that would be great for our industry. Day one adds so much more value to the ad tech companies in their space, and it gives a lot more freedom to agencies who are not then roped into using Google all the time. You know, I wouldn't let Apple run a marketplace selling its own products. I think that is absolutely crazy for what they've done. And I would break up Google. I would break up Facebook. I'd take Instagram off them and WhatsApp. I want them as independent companies. But I certainly think that this is the logical thing to do. You know, I think obviously the UK has taken the decision to leave the EU and doing its own thing and let, you know, whoever's in power just play God for a while and make up their own laws as they go along. But yeah, like at the end of the day, it comes down to the fact that we need to kind of restrict the monopolistic behavior of these companies. I am not against companies growing or even making money. I'm against companies doing what Apple did in the first story or you know, what Facebook and Google were doing in terms of collusion, what Amazon's been doing around its marketplace, and actually owning the entire supply chain, which I think is dangerous as well. You know, the Amazon supply chain is a bigger threat to the economy as a whole, particularly Europe, because all they can do is slot into new things like, you know, convenience stores. They've got two stores down in Canary Wharf, which are, they don't have any cashiers, right? They're pushing this out. And, you know, that's the next thing they'll go into. They'll go into health. They'll go into education. And as an institution, we expect the EU to protect the rights of indigenous companies and other companies globally to work fairly in that. They can't be able to use their monopolistic heft in vertical industries to pour into other industries and basically price gouge everybody and then kill off the competition. So I think that this is a sensible approach, but I do not want the EU to be watered down by the lobbyists of these big tech companies, which inevitably pay a ton of money to their consultants to lobby the various MEPs and MPs. There'll be plenty of lobbyists in the House of Parliament whispering sweet nothings into Labour and Conservative Lib Dem MPs' ears. So I think sensibly, centralising is a good way, but I want to get more aggressive in these companies.
On that sort of lobbying point, do you think that the big tech firms will threaten to reduce their activity within European markets? And will
please
we
do.
See-
please go away. I will have a party if Google leaves Europe, because it would leave such a fucking massive bonanza for the rest of us. Amazon and Apple and Google and Meta, I'll be delighted. They should go away. Go back to the US. We don't want them here.
I disagree. I like all those companies, apart from Apple. Apple are getting on my nerves at the moment.
No, I like Apple. I don't like Facebook. I don't like Meta.
Do you know what? I don't like, well, goodness me. Facebook can be challenging to work with, but you can't deliver that they give a lifeline to thousands of small businesses in terms of selling and building businesses. And you can't take that away from them. They are the tightest platform for doing that. As a platform, I don't love them. As a sales channel, they work.
Yeah, but I would disagree. In the sense that I think that metrics are meta metrics. There's no third party verification of the success. There's no third party verification over the quality of their content. I also question the numbers on their platform, because
sales don't lie. Sales don't lie. You're looking at the sales and you're looking at the advertising investment, and Facebook drives sales. Not so much anymore. Post ATT, it's becoming a lot more difficult, but it traditionally is the best platform. You can build a tight funnel within that platform for a brand that has no brand awareness. For smaller businesses, it's the most effective channel. And to take that away is going to kill the livelihood of a lot of small businesses.
They'll find a way.
They're trying. We're all trying.
Yeah.
Is it a case of the simple nature of the platform and the scale it purportedly offers, or is there a way of independent ad tech and independent publishers filling that gap that Facebook?
If you have something like a unified ID, like the Trade Desk are developing, and you can run that across a multitude of independent publishers, and you can build a tight funnel across those publishers at a low cost with a really strong algorithm, yes, it could work exactly the same. But does it exist at the moment?
No. I would never. Let's be honest, that is not going to happen. This idea that we're going to have a magic ID is not going to happen. You've got three key problems here, right? You've got legislation, GDPR, CCPA. You've got tech. Apple are not going to let that happen again. And then Mozilla and even Google are fighting internally about whether or not they're going to do it. And then finally, you've got the user privacy piece. Like, every time you try and hack privacy, you're going to have a Johnny Ryan, or you're going to have some other lunatic coming at you aggressively and trying to take you down, as per the IAB's framework for sharing data. So I don't think, I think as an industry, we're going to have to really rethink a lot of stuff we do. And I agree with you to a point, Giddy, that it's tough for a small publisher or small brand who's used that infrastructure to make it work for them, and then it ties it back to sales. But I would argue that I wonder if Facebook is getting too much credit for a lot of those sales in many ways, and that that maybe we're exposing that it's not all down to Facebook. But you are right about the ease that they make it easy for brands to scale. I mean, Jesus, you can target people in Japan using the Facebook infrastructure. We've done it before in a previous life. With our own ATS events. So I agree with you that, but I don't think there's going to be a savior, an ID savior here. I think the Trade Desk ID will cover a small patch of the open web, and then we're going to have to rethink a lot of the other stuff, which will be hard, don't get me wrong. But,
I just see a massive move to content marketing. The performance channels just aren't working. People are having to invest in influencers and content and creative, which actually makes advertising a bit more fun again.
Also, I think that you're gonna have new metrics like attention-based metrics that will actually replace a lot of the cookie-based window stuff that we had previously. I mean, we're already seeing it. I mean, if you're running video, how many people watched it? And then being able to tie that back to a sales outcome. Like, so I think you're right about the influencers. I think they're going to be a big part of it as well, which is great. It's great for your agency. You know?
Yeah. It's good for us. Well, I mean, we just have to keep changing what we do, which is fun.
Yeah. It gets boring otherwise.
It gets boring. Exactly. We like the challenge.
Constantly changing industry and more importantly, fun as well. Moving into the second part of the podcast where we find out from Katie all about what's going on at the Runway Media and current projects in focus heading into Q4. So Katie, over to you.
Thanks, Matt. So I set up the Runway Media to work with a lot of the startup and scale-up brands that we've just been talking about, small businesses who want to grow their businesses through digital channels and through offline channels too. Everything at the Runway is going really, really well. It's an absolute relief to be out of lockdown and be working with people in person again, as I'm sure you guys are finding too. We are currently deep in preparations for Cyber Week and for Christmas. We're having a lot of fun. We are currently being challenged by the Shopify Facebook integration across many of our clients, and which is something I'm sure a lot of your listeners have encountered. I sound like an absolute broken record going on about ATT this morning, and for that I apologise. But post ATT, it does seem that the Shopify Facebook integration just isn't fit for purpose. So there's a lot of manual development work happening behind the scenes. All good fun. We're learning lots. I'm learning quite a lot about being a web dev at the moment, which is something I didn't think I signed up to when I started working in advertising all those years ago. But yeah, it's very interesting.
Is that something you think is just as a result of Shopify and Facebook trying to catch up as a result of ATT, or is it something that you think maybe a longer term issue that will need to be resolved outside of that?
They're just different. They're different companies, and they've got this integration that sits between them. And really, one or the other of them needs to own that integration, because both of them are kind of stabbing in the dark. We're currently dealing with various different stakeholders, individual web devs, web dev companies, the Shopify main team, specific Facebook reps, and all they can do is provide best practice. It's very, very difficult. Someone needs to take ownership of that integration, which must be the most important integration, you would think, globally for Facebook. So I'm not quite sure why it's not getting the attention it needs.
Well, they're too busy thinking about the metaverse. rather than realizing that they need an addressable e-commerce platform integration, because with ATT now, how do you say that impression resulted in a sale if you don't have some way of like having an outcomes based element to it, which is what Shopify integration is about, I guess. So, in terms of measurement and attribution, it's so important to them to have that. I mean, they'd probably love to buy Shopify, but they're never, it's never going to happen in a million fucking years. that's the great thing about this, is that these big companies are completely handcuffed in terms of what they can and can't buy. But I guess it's a pain for you guys, because, they're kind of like putting you on the long finger in terms of sorting this integration out.
Yeah, it's very painful. But anyway, apart from that, we are doing a lot of content work at the moment, which is really interesting, because we kind of come from a performance marketing background. But as you've got the aggregators now, they're just so wealthy, the booking.coms, the Compare the Markets, they're tying up the front page of Google across multiple verticals. ATT, again, very, very hard to run app download campaigns. We're finding that a lot of effective marketing results actually come from long funnel activity, like building messaging houses, running an ECRM strategy, and actually looking at the social content calendar and all of these kind of more things that might have been perceived as actually quite fluffy parts of the kind of marketing funnel are actually now becoming absolutely integral.
See, it's a flight to quality. Content is king in the end. Maybe we got addicted to that easy performance-based stuff that actually didn't really, that really didn't deliver. I mean, it delivered from an optics point of view, but in reality, we're going back to actually brand messaging, but with data-driven aspects to it rather than just old school. But it's funny, we had the conference we did 2 weeks ago about the out-of-home thing, and it just dawned on me how effective that's going to be, because they've actually spent a lot of time building data-driven aspects to it. But it's an incredibly strong platform to build branding, and more DTC brands are coming into it because realizing that, just to your point, Gideon, is like, I don't want to spend a shit ton of money on Facebook when I have no idea what the outcomes are. Or I don't really want to spend a load of money on the Apple ecosystem because it's already oversubscribed by big brands. There's no democratization piece about it. So actually building content that reflects the brand's principles and outcomes is a powerful ally now.
Absolutely. And it's a differentiator rather than who can pay more for a click.
In terms of that content side of things, are you seeing a marked difference in the terms of content that's appealing to consumers and marketers this year compared to last year, or is it broadly similar?
Oh, it's a very good question. Do you know what? It follows consumer trends. So obviously last year, everyone's locked in their houses doing online workouts and making soda bread and banana bread and all that other stuff. Whereas now we're seeing an uptake in, I don't know, fashion and things that pertain to kind of consumption, being out the house, restaurants and food and drink. And a lot of people are putting their Pelotons on eBay. So it really follows consumer trends, what people are looking at the time. People are starting to get interested in travel again. I do think that the kind of the lazy content creation aspect of, oh, it's Valentine's Day, so let's put up a picture of a heart, it just doesn't work anymore. People are so bored of that kind of thing. And it's the automatic way just to lose followers. So everything we do starts with a messaging house and what's the most important things to the brand. And then we build out the content strategy around that.
Has that changed your agency model a little bit then, Katie? Because you seem to have, like, I wouldn't say pivoted, but you kind of gravitated from like performance-based stuff now to like, yeah, we're now like content creation based.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's all performance-based. It's all performance-based because obviously then content creation leads back to SEO.
Yeah, okay.
So yeah, it's all one package. But what it has changed is that you can no longer say, right, okay, if you give me this budget, I can get you a positive return on ad spend by next month. Because you can't guarantee that anymore. Now retargeting's gone away. You can hope, you can do your best, but instead we're looking at more of a longer term funnel. So going, okay, let's look at what you want to do. Let's look at what the 3 to 6 month plan is and what we put out there, and building an organic audience who then can refer on.
Interesting.
As opposed to just paying for users and getting eyeballs. And you know what? Long term, it's better for brand health because you're getting people that are interested in the brand. They're going to have longer lifetime values for the brand. We've got some brands who are now looking at 4-year lifetime values of customers.
There you go. There we go. We've come out of the, you know, we're looking long. I actually think this is going to be really good for our industry. I despair at the sort of instant hits and wins on Facebook when really you're not building brand longevity or even, you know, a connection with your customers. It's getting back to old time principles, but applying what we've learned over the last 10, 20 years. So I actually think this is going to be very good for the industry, and we'll get to a point where these walled gardens will be part of the mix, but they won't be the mix. And that's the thing that really excites me about this. It's like, I would fare smaller brands not to have their entire marketing piece built on Facebook and Google. I think it's really dangerous for them, because actually what are they, like you talk about 4 years, that's a good way to think about your business rather than the ephemeral hit every quarter, right? It's like, how do I get someone to actually invest in my brand over a longer period of time, you know? And that's the way you capture those longer staying customers.
Absolutely. And that's how these bigger companies, that's how the big blue chip companies look at brand and product development. They look at a 5-year life cycle. They don't look at how many users can we get in month 2.
Yeah. And I think this is going to be very interesting. I think your agency is a interesting case study for the evolution of the space. Like, so this is good. And I think we'll and on the measurement side, I think we're going to do more. We're going to see more attention-based stuff around video and more clever panel-based stuff, which can be tied back to the clever attribution. I think this is the type of stuff that I love to hear. While we despair at the lack of the death of the cookie and the ATT, it's like the industry has a remarkable ability to evolve. And I, you know, 10 years of seeing two companies just suck up all the spend spaces made me sick. I have no sympathy for Meta. I do not cry any tears over ATT. I actually think Apple has done us a massive favor in the long term by blunting the likes of them and Google. And, you know, Google will not get away with Flock either because it won't pass the privacy smell test. So these are all upsides, Katie, especially for your fantastic agency. So more power to you.
Thank you very much, Kieran.
Looking forward to see the exciting and open ecosystem alongside Kieran's wallpaper dancing. And that just about draws us out of time. But Kieran, Katie, thanks ever so much for joining me.
It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And thank you all ever so much for listening. That was this week's MadTech Podcast.